Welcome. My name is Anthony Patch, and this is Pulse. This is our new YouTube program that my wife Kathleen and myself are producing along with Doug Diamond from Diamond Digital Media. It's been a long time since we hosted a live stream, if you will, a recording such as this. YouTube deleted one of our channels. We have a backup channel that has a few videos on there that we have posted over the last couple of years. But this is really the first time that I've taken the time to sit down and speak with you. And the reason for this is really the geopolitical events that are occurring. I find myself compelled to speak to you somewhat in a live fashion. I'm recording this, but this will be presented later on today. This is the 11th of July, Thursday. Tonight I will be producing a live stream, live, as we do 3 days a week, Tuesday, Thursday, and Sunday. Kathleen and I host a two-hour live stream that really is a teaching format. Today, I'm not really here to teach, although I do want to speak about the current geopolitical situation with respect to Russia, Ukraine, and Israel, and Gaza, and Hezbollah, and greater Iran. Those are really the reasons, the motivations for putting together this program today, which will then continue as events unfold. And again, I consider this taking the pulse of geopolitical events that include not just politics, but economics, certainly the military situations. And so as these rapidly unfolding events do unfold, I will be presenting more of these recordings. I call them live streams just from habit. There are about 8,800 subscribers on this channel. I hope that most of you see this recording and return for future live streams, probably 2 to 3 times per week because events are unfolding so quickly. I will be recording these Pulse presentations in addition to the two-hour teachings from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time here in the United States that is broadcast really out to the world. And we have the opportunity through these subscriptions to speak to many of our subscribers one-on-one. Apart from the live stream, we have Skype and cell phone calls that subscribers can choose to speak with myself and with my wife, Kathleen, personally, individually, to continue the teaching process and to build friendships as we have done. So really, we have been providing these live streams since 2018. There are now some 850 live streams archived at our website, anthonypatch.com. Subscribers have full access to all of those videos. They also have full access in our archives to each monthly edition to Entangled Magazine, which we founded, Kathleen and myself, founded in June of 2017. And we publish this every month. And each of those editions are likewise available in the archives at anthonypatch.com. So I would ask you to, if you're already subscribing, to hit the like button and hit the notification bell so that as we go forward with these Pulse videos, you will be notified. And if you would care to contact us through the contact tab at anthonypatch.com and send us your email, we will also send out email notifications of each of these Pulse videos here on YouTube. One of the primary reasons we were censored by YouTube and Patreon, our former subscription platform, we now use Subscribestar and a second. YouTube, Patreon, and PayPal censored us because of our biblical perspective on world events, on science and technology, which includes genetic modification. Science, technology, genetic modification, economics, global politics, geopolitics, all viewed through the lens of a biblical perspective, those conversations, those teachings take place on our private platform, which if you subscribe, and you can do that through anthonypatch.com, you can participate in these teachings. We have a live band platform that functions much like a chat room, but it's a private chat room on Band, B-A-N-D. And as a subscriber, you can participate in that live. And we have live back and forth interaction on Band while I'm presenting, and Kathleen as well, we are presenting the subject or multiple subjects for that evening's teaching. So there's quite a comprehensive amount of information in the archives, as well as each week, three times a week, we're teaching. And it's amazing to me how many people have stayed with us for so many years and set aside 6 hours per week consistently to hear the lessons. And it's not just Kathleen and I presenting information in a static sort of platform. It's really a back and forth through Band that we're able to do, and then followed up with private Skype calls and cell phone calls. So if that appeals to you, if you would like to join with us in these live streams that we've been doing since 2018, we welcome you. And that's sort of the administrative material that I wanted to present tonight, today, whenever it is that you're viewing this video. But I do want to speak a little bit about geopolitics, and I will get to that in just a moment. Here on this YouTube platform, we will present the information from a secular perspective. I mentioned the biblical perspective just so that you understand where I'm coming from, but I will not be providing biblical scripture and interpretation and application here on this platform, again, due to censorship. This is why we have the private platform, is because of the biblical perspective that we choose to share with you, and has proven, I think, to be very helpful and beneficial to many, many people. And we hope to continue that. The times require this. So I will not get into the biblical here because, again, this is YouTube, but that is where you can find the biblical, is through the subscription process. Okay? I'm sitting here in my home office. Behind me, you see my bookcases, and those are ducks up there. I call those all my ducks in a row. We try to be organized. We try to present things in a very cogent, very sober, very prudent, very educational format. But because we're here in my home, in the home that Kathleen, my wife, and I share with our dogs and our other animals, we have a little sort of hobby farm here in New Hampshire. We're in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. One of the drawbacks is we sit right on the two-lane highway that goes through our small valley here in the mountains. It's a rather busy road, and so I apologize up front if you hear background noise. Also, occasionally our yellow labs, like to bark. And they're very good watchdogs, so if you hear dogs barking in the background, that's just our two animals doing what they do. like to do. This is our home. We welcome you into our home. It's not a formal studio. I'm not a formal presenter. Try to do this in a very natural manner, and I think many people appreciate that. It's what I feel most comfortable doing. I really don't deviate from that. I don't get into sensational. When I do consider things from my own perspective, my own conclusions, my own expectations, I try to preface those with those labels. I'm not a prophet, neither is Kathleen. We don't profess to be able to predict the future, nor do we attempt any prediction of the future. But we do observe, we look at patterns of behavior in people, patterns within events that unfold, and therefore lay out our expectations of how we think things will continue to unfold, what pattern will continue to present itself. We are, as I say, not prophets. We are not trying to present fear. We're not fear mongers. We are not conspiracy theorists, as the overused old label is out there. We're not. We base our observations, expectations, conclusions for the most part, from our reading and understanding of the Bible, which we consider Scripture to be the truth, and couple that with scientific research. We go to the source material. We go to the peer-reviewed scientific papers that are published in the scientific journals. We interpret those. We reveal the truth as we glean from the science. And we also present patents related to the science, and we speak to the issues of the day in healthcare, biology, genetics, and then we also look at, and again, this is reflective of our scientific research, we look at economic trends, we look at what's going on in the banking world, the Federal Reserve, the central banks of the world, where the economics of the world are going, where it's leading us to. We do deep dives into that. And in addition to that, we go into the world events, and that's where I would like to go today. We can put the label of geopolitics on it if we want. So I'd like to segue over to that, but just make one last mention about Entangled Magazine. Entangled Magazine is our resource to continue the teaching that we introduce in the live streams, and we condense what we've presented for the month into our monthly magazine and provide the reference, the source materials from our teaching. We provide excerpts from the cited scientific papers, economic papers. Our sources are cited as to the website, the papers, the journals, the authors, and provide excerpts from those in the magazine and provide our commentary to that evidence, to that source material. And it's proven to be a very effective teaching methodology. The environment within our live streams, we have often said, and this is reflected in our magazine entitled Entangled Magazine, from quantum entanglement, from quantum mechanics and particle physics, something that we go into as well. We go into physics, generally speaking quantum mechanics, and oftentimes we are citing the events that are taking place at CERN, the Large Hadron Collider, something that many of you are familiar with my presentations over the years, which really began in January of 2013. I really began to go public with my scientific research and observations. We have attempted to, and I think we've been successful, reasonably successful, in setting up a learning environment in the live streams, in our chat room that is known as Band. Band's the platform. And certainly within the pages of Entangled Magazine, a learning environment. Not a sensational, not, as I said, a fear-mongering, not a conspiratorial environment, but one in which we can approach from a sober mindset, pragmatic mindset, looking at the facts, looking at the evidence. And oftentimes we present the evidence as would be found and experienced within a courtroom. So if that appeals to you, if that is something that might be refreshing to you in terms of a format and the opportunity to learn from valid sources, we invite you to join us to do that, okay? So again, 850 live streams plus, I mean, we add to them as we will tonight, 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. You can join us by going to anthonypatch.com. Go to the homepage, click on the tab at the top that says subscribe, and follow through the steps. And that will also provide you access to Band. All of the steps are clearly laid out for you. Okay? Today and yesterday and Tuesday of this week, NATO, celebrating its 75th anniversary, has been meeting, the NATO members have been meeting in Washington, D.C. Tuesday, Wednesday, and then they conclude today, Thursday. So this is where I'd like to leap off in our discussion today about geopolitics. No doubt all of you are very familiar with what's been going on in Ukraine with respect to Russia and with respect to NATO and the United States. I won't be doing a deep dive here today. I just want to give you some observations, some conclusions that I've drawn. I will elaborate on this and do a deep dive, as we like to say, later on tonight in tonight's live stream. Each live stream tends to be different from the preceding one. Sometimes we'll do two or three on a given topic area, but most of the time we provide one topic, like I will tonight, and then Sunday, the next live stream, it will be a different topic. It depends on what's going on in the world. So it's not just one topic from live stream to live stream. That would prove to be rather tedious and boring for all of us, okay, including myself. But Russia, Russia, Ukraine, and NATO at large. NATO has already stated, and it is due to be presented at the conclusion tonight in Washington, D.C., of NATO, their position with respect to the war in Ukraine to a much lesser degree. There's been very little discussion about what has been happening with respect to Israel and the Palestinians, specifically in Gaza, and the looming threat in Lebanon to the north, the northern border of Israel, with Hezbollah, and by greater extension, Iran itself. So the focus of NATO, they have chosen, the President Biden in the opening presentation that he made, is to look at the state of the situation with Ukraine and Russia. And NATO has made it very clear, as the President has made very clear, that NATO is continuing to support Ukraine and, in fact, is going to dramatically increase the military and economic support to Ukraine. The President, President Biden, because I speak to an international audience here, President Biden had made it very clear that the United States going forward fully intends to defeat Russia on the battlefield, stating that NATO has in the NATO countries, including the United States, but specifically in Europe, 100,000 NATO troops that are ready to support Ukraine. When I say support Ukraine, that means to engage in battle against Russia. In fact, what has been coming out from many of the participants in the leadership positions of NATO is that they want to, quote, Trump-proof. Trump. Trump-proof NATO. I cite this at the beginning in order to give you a sense of the time frame that we're looking at for these activities by NATO against Russia. Now, I'm not taking a position in terms of I'm in support of NATO, I'm in support of Ukraine against Russia, or I'm in support of Russia against Ukraine and greater NATO. My purpose, and Kathleen's purpose as well, our method, if you will, is to report what we consider the facts and the evidence, and also present our commentary, our conclusions. We have roughly 3 months before the November elections in the United States. The present administration obviously wants to remain in power. Whether that is President Biden continuing as the candidate or turning over the candidacy to another, whether he is, if he continues, whether he's elected or not, obviously the goal of the present administration is to remain in power. So when NATO members, and in particular United States representatives in NATO, use the label Trump-proof, they expect that former President Trump, that Donald Trump, should he regain the presidency, would, at a minimum, cease to provide funding and military personnel and equipment, cease to provide funding and support to NATO. Not so much a actual withdrawal from NATO, but doing nothing, doing something significant by not taking action, by not continuing to provide funding effectively, and by not providing troops and military equipment, armaments, and the like, effectively does remove the United States from participating in NATO. And this is what the present administration and present administrations of NATO members, be they the political leaders and the military leaders of the NATO member nations, they do not want the largest member, largest economic supporter and military supporter of NATO to withdraw or to reduce its support of NATO. The stated goal by the present NATO leadership is to continue the war in Ukraine to the point of defeating Russia on the battlefield, and to continue beyond the physical borders of Ukraine into Russia itself for the stated purpose of breaking down the Russian Republic into individual states. From an economic standpoint, this is for the control, access and control of the resources to be found both in Ukraine and in the Russian Republic. You could call this greed. So understanding the big picture, the long picture, the long stated goals of NATO and the United States and the present administration, the present administration does not want a change in leadership. Nor does NATO want a change in leadership. When I say leadership, I mean United States. Pardon me. This gives us a sense of the timing of events. We have roughly 3 months. NATO has roughly 3 months. Ukraine and Russia has roughly 3 months. 3 months to do what? What would ensure the present U.S. administration remaining in power? It would be a defeat of Russia. A military defeat of Russia. How can this be accomplished in 3 months? Because that's really what they're saying without saying it. The present administration, should it experience a defeat in Ukraine, would therefore lose in the ballot box. It doesn't necessarily reflect that the majority of U.S. citizens are in support of the war in Ukraine, that they want a defeat of Russia. It's hard to gauge, if you will, the pulse, the sentiment of the U.S. population at this point. Things are in such a disarray. There's so much polarization within the citizenry of the United States. It's hard to really get a read on this. But generally speaking, if we focus on the political leadership here in this country, and really not so much the military leadership in this country, but the political leadership, the administration, they are seeking to remain in power by defeating Russia before the November election. The United States military consists of about 450,000 active duty personnel. There are well over 1 million active duty personnel with respect to the Russian military. The Russian military, by the present administration views the Russian military in much the same light as the previous administrations in the early 1990s. 1990, 91, the fall of the Berlin Wall that preceded it, but then the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. And so that mindset persists today in the present administration to the extent that they consider statements made by Putin and his military leaders as merely bluffing. Bluffing as to what they will do in Ukraine, what they will do to NATO allies. The image that is put forth by the present administration and NATO at large is that Russia is the aggressor, that Russia is seeking not only to occupy all of Ukraine, but to move on the NATO nations and occupy Europe. This is what is being put out to the general public. This is the propaganda that is being put out. Yet Putin, in his press conferences, really since the war began right around February in 2022, has stated unequivocally that he wants peace, that he wants economic relationships with Ukraine and NATO, that he does not want to go to war, that economically and militarily, he does not want to occupy Ukraine, much less Europe. And when you look at it from an economic standpoint, the Russian economic standpoint, although Russia is doing very well despite the sanctions by the United States. The World Bank, in fact, this week said and stated and rated the Russian economy as a thriving economy, as an exceptionally wealthy economy. The World Bank. Russia has achieved this economic growth. I think it was put at something like 24% per annum growth in the Russian economy, 24% growth. And this has been achieved because they have sought economic partnerships with China in particular, India, you know about the BRICS nations, and the Shanghai Cooperative Organization, SCO. The members of SCO, which include Russia, China, India, and so forth, mirror the members of BRICS. Not identically, but the major players are in BRICS, and the major players are in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which was founded in 2021. First for the purpose of security between the member nations, but also now, to a greater extent, the SCO functions as an economic partnership between member nations. And there is the expectation that BRICS and the Shanghai Cooperative Organization or Cooperation Organization, the SCO and BRICS, will merge. What in effect is happening with that merger is the exclusion of the United States and really the exclusion of the NATO member nations, which really is comprised of the EU. Now the president, the current president of the EU, the Prime Minister of Hungary, has been operating, and it's a six-month rotating presidential position. The Prime Minister of Hungary has been met with Putin, met with Xi in China, and has met with Zelensky in Ukraine to try to broker a peace agreement, a ceasefire and a peace agreement. The Prime Minister of Slovakia is also seeking the same. While we see the Prime Minister of Poland acting in the opposite direction as a provocateur, and I won't elaborate on this, but a provocateur against Russia. So within the ranks of the EU and within the ranks of NATO, we see this division that is occurring. Those that want peace and those that want war. So again, I'll focus because I'm somewhat U.S.-centric in my perspective. We'll focus on the present administration choosing war rather than a ceasefire. And the answer to why they are seeking the extension of the war, the continuation of the war, and now, as they are announcing, aggressively ramping up the military capabilities of NATO to be the aggressor. Specifically, NATO countries as the aggressor against Russia is for the purpose of this administration, because the U.S. is the largest participant in NATO, economically and militarily. This administration wants to stay in power, and they choose war rather than peace to ensure that position of power. Whether that includes Biden or not, it is this group that wants to remain in power. So there is approximately 3 months that NATO views as its window of opportunity to aggressively increase NATO's capabilities. You'll recall that when Donald Trump was president, he was castigating the European members of NATO insofar as their lack of financial contribution financial contribution to NATO. Today, just in the last several weeks, 3 or 4 weeks, NATO members in Europe have been ramping up to, on average, a 2% of GDP, 2% economic support for NATO, 2% of their GDP. So they're pulling from other areas in their budgets, in their line item budgets, pulling funds from those budget items and focusing them into military expenditures. They're not going to do that for peaceful purposes. This is not simply to support the Ukrainian military, which on average, there are some 2,000 casualties and injuries, deaths and injuries, 2,000 Ukrainian troops per day, 2,000 a day. Those are the numbers that the Ukrainian military is suffering. This is a war of attrition. NATO is realizing that this decimation by Russia of the Ukrainian military puts the present administration here in the U.S., as well as NATO at large, in the position of no longer having the capability of using Ukraine as a proxy. The Ukrainian military has been the proxy of NATO to fight NATO's battle against Russia. Again, the long-range goal of NATO is to break up the Russian Federation into individual states. The goal of Russia, going back to 2021, predating the outbreak of this conflict of hostilities, the goal of Russia, let's cite Putin in particular, has been to block Ukraine from joining NATO. What's the rationale on the part of Putin, Moscow? I'll give you an example. Here in the United States, if Russia decided to install large numbers of military troops and missiles in support of the missile capabilities, Russian troops in Mexico at our southern border, the United States would take exception to that. The United States and NATO have installed military troops in support of missile systems deployed in Ukraine at the Russian border. Now, there's other support activities, but I want to focus on the missiles. This is why Russia took exception to the United States in particular placing missiles on the Russian border. In November of 2021, Biden made the statement to Putin that he would never allow U.S. missiles in Ukraine. By February and March of the following year, 2022, the U.S. deployed missiles on the Russian border. Now, there are other reasons why Russia, quote, invaded Ukraine. Some of it I'll briefly outline is that the Russians themselves, the Russian communities in Ukraine, on the Russian border, were under severe assault, I'll call it, by the Western Ukrainians, the non-Russian, by language, by culture, non-Russian inhabitants of Ukraine, were terrorizing the Russian-speaking, Russian culture occupants of the border areas in Ukraine bordering Russia. So Russian forces were deployed to come in and protect Russians from Ukrainians. When those troops arrived, initially the Russian-speaking culture welcomed those Russians as brothers and said, "We're happy you're here. Are you going to stay?" The Russian military were under orders not to occupy that Ukrainian territory. And when this was made known to those Russian occupants of Ukraine, they told the Russian military to leave because they knew that the Ukrainian secret police would come against those Russians because they would be viewed as collaborators with an invading Russian army. You don't hear that part of the story. And the other part is the provocative move by the U.S. to place missiles on the Russian border. So we lied to the Russians about the missiles and a great deal more. Now, there was an accord, a peace treaty that was negotiated in Turkey, Istanbul, the Istanbul Accord, and it was initialed by Putin and his negotiators. It was agreed upon, and then the U.S. used the United Kingdom to deliver the message to Ukraine to not sign this peace accord. We almost had peace, but the United States, NATO, said no to Ukraine. Again, Ukraine is the proxy. So today, because the Ukrainian military is nearing extinction, NATO is gearing up. And it is not to simply send equipment and financial support to Ukraine, because they need to send boots on the ground. Evidence of this is not necessarily boots on the ground, but so to speak, F-16 fighter jets produced in the United States that have been deployed for a number of years in Denmark have now been deployed from Denmark to Ukraine. Ukrainian pilots have been trained in the United States in the F-16. And they are now going to occupy, boots on the ground, those Ukrainian pilots will occupy those F-16s that will be forward deployed into Ukraine itself. This has been going on just in the last couple of days. There is speculation that U.S. pilots will don Ukrainian uniforms and also pilot those F-16s. Now, I can't verify that. That's just the discussion that is floating around at this point. But this shows you that F-16s are escalating the threat to Russia. Now, Russia's been expecting this. The consequences of F-16s, I'll briefly, there are a lot of consequences, but I'll give you one prime example, the leading example of why Russia is concerned about these F-16s. They are not only fighter jets, but they can carry a nuclear warhead. Now, they don't fly as fast. They are capable of Mach 2, which is twice the speed of sound. They can fly at twice the speed of sound and deliver a nuclear gravity bomb into Russian territory. But compared to a tactical missile, aircraft are much slower. They're slower because you have to get the pilot into the aircraft. It has to travel down the runway. It needs to get airborne. It needs to get to altitude and then get on target. That all takes a lot more time than pushing the launch button on a missile that can deliver a tactical nuke. So Russia, already concerned about nuclear-capable missiles on their borders, now have those missiles backed up by F-16s. Now, you may or may not have heard, but about 4 weeks ago, U.S.-supplied missiles attempted to take out, to blind Russia's early warning system, their radar stations. They have 10 radar installations that are their early warning system for nuclear attack. There was an attempt to take out three of those installations. Two were only overflown by drones, but one was actually struck by U.S.-made missiles delivered by Ukraine that took out two towers of this radar installation. When you begin, if you think about SALT Treaty, SALT I Treaty, SALT II Treaty, the INF Treaty, when you talk about nuclear treaties, non-proliferation treaties and the like, when you look at a potential adversary and say, we're going to blind their early warning system, how does your adversary receive that information concerning their early warning system being targeted and perhaps even attacked? This is the situation that the world finds itself in right now. Because in the discussions of those treaties over the years, since the early 80s, it had always been understood that, number one, you would never threaten to use nuclear warheads, never verbalize that into the world community, into the global community. You don't threaten to use nukes, okay? Today, we find those threats being verbalized. The other is that you do not threaten your adversary's early warning systems. That is extremely provocative. So what would be the natural response? Let's go to the worst case scenario. If US, Ukraine, NATO did decide in a major way to attack the early warning systems of Russia. Now, Russia does not have the satellite-based early warning system that the United States has. We have a much more sophisticated system. Russia is primarily dependent on their ground-based radar installations along their borders to detect the incoming tactical nukes from short and medium range missiles, and certainly the launch and incoming of intercontinental ballistic missiles from the United States, from continental United States, from CONUS. Should NATO choose to attack those early warning systems, Russia would view that, as Putin has stated publicly since 2021, an exceptional condition manifesting as threatening Russian sovereignty and Russian territory. That exceptional condition threatening sovereignty and territory would be enough, and I'm paraphrasing but almost verbatim, would be enough to consider an exceptional response by Moscow. Exceptional response is the launching by Russia of intercontinental ballistic missiles in addition to short and medium range tactical missiles. NATO is going to send boots on the ground, not just F-16s. This is why President Biden was bragging that they have 100,000 NATO troops battle ready on the ground in Europe, ready to support Ukraine. What does he mean by ready to support Ukraine? That's 100,000 troops, boots on the ground. Whether they're flying aircraft or what, it's boots on the ground in Ukraine. Now, Russia's been expecting this. Certainly, they have the human intelligence and sophisticated technical surveillance and intelligence gathering mechanisms to know that this was going to be discussed at NATO, and NATO is openly declaring this now. Boots on the ground in Ukraine. Because the Ukrainian military is virtually decimated. So this brings us back to the time frame, 3 months roughly to the elections. 3 months, will the Ukrainian military even exist in 3 months? Losing some 2,000 men, dead and wounded every single day. And they're already outmanned 10 to 1 by the Russian forces that are already deployed in the eastern territories of Ukraine and the Russian border areas. Russia has been advancing 1 to 2 kilometers per day, not 5 kilometers, not 10 kilometers. The Western media wants to say Russia has been stopped, the invasion has been slowed, Russia has nearly been defeated, which is absolutely not. They're misreading the restraint on the part of Putin. So let's go to the diplomatic discussion. Putin has openly stated he wants peace. He wants a business relationship with countries around the world, which he has been very effectively achieving. He has met with Xi in China. Xi in China and North Korea and Vietnam. He has a business relationship now that's been solidified with Vietnam. He has a mutual defense agreement in hand with North Korea, Kim Jong-un, and an economic agreement with North Korea. North Korea now is positioned to defend Russia. Russia is positioned to defend North Korea. But the more important is the other way around. North Korea coming to the aid of Russia. You know that North Korea has been testing intercontinental ballistic missiles, boosters, suborbital and orbital capable boosters. These are for carrying nuclear warheads. Russia is supplying the nuclear warheads to North Korea to support Russia. Russia is well equipped militarily, economically, politically in alignment, militarily in alignment. But let's go to the diplomatic tactics of Putin. Putin has been very restrained with the use of the military. One, because he does not want Russian soldiers dying. So he's not going to be overly aggressive. He's going to rely on artillery and missiles and bomber aircraft, fighter aircraft that can dual role, that can deliver gravity bombs and deliver glider bombs and hypersonic missiles, rather than boots on the ground that are engaged in face-to-face combat with the Ukrainian military. It's not because they're fearful or thinking that the Ukrainian military is somehow exceptional. It is to conserve Russian lives. That serves politically, serves Putin's desire to remain in power. Putin has stated that with the goals of Russia, of Moscow, the goals of Moscow from the beginning has been with Ukraine, not to occupy Ukraine. Militarily, they don't want to lose personnel and then expend more personnel as an occupying force. And economically, Russia does not view itself as able to afford the economic expense of occupying Ukraine. You don't hear that in the Western media. Thus, what Moscow wants, what Putin wants, is a demilitarization of Ukraine through negotiation, not on the battlefield. A demilitarization of Ukraine with respect to NATO, that Ukraine shift to a neutral position and move away from seeking membership in NATO, and lastly, a denazification, a removal of the Nazis from Ukraine. The United States has been supporting the Nazi regime, which includes two divisions of Nazi military troops, is supporting membership of Ukraine in NATO, and now it's been leaked just yesterday. It's been leaked out of this 75-year celebration of NATO. It has been leaked that the word in the documents that have been leaked, the word inevitable. It is inevitable, according to NATO, that Ukraine will, in the coming years, they indicate it's over a period of years, that at some point in the over the next several years, Ukraine will inevitably be accepted as a member of NATO. And that the NATO military will be rebuilt. All to the complete opposite of what Putin is seeking. So achieving common ground for a ceasefire is really prevented by NATO. NATO was formed for peace, as a defensive organization against the former Soviet Union, and by extension, possibly against communist China. The roles have reversed. NATO is now the aggressor. They are now offensive. They claim that they are defending Ukraine against an invading enemy, Russia. I've explained the history of what went on at the Russian border, despite what Western media says. Russia is not invading. They were trying to defend, protect their own culturally significant Russian people in Ukraine. You know that Ukraine used to be part of the Soviet Union. It was the center, it was the heart of the Soviet Union, Ukraine was. Prior to 2014, the Ukrainian political leadership elected, democratically elected, presidency and administration of Ukraine. Prior to 2014, that democratic government wanted, and it was in their constitutional papers, that Ukraine would remain neutral, that it would not seek membership in NATO. The CIA came in and facilitated the overthrow of a democratically elected government in Ukraine and installed the puppet Zelensky, who effectively was a dictator, secret police, increased the military, became the aggressor against Russia as a proxy of the United States and NATO. And Zelensky was supposed to serve a term of not more than 5 years. His term has long since expired, and he now is an illegal dictator of Ukraine. Again, you don't hear this in the Western media. NATO is in support of this dictator. And yet NATO says, and the President of the United States says, we are trying to ensure the longevity, the existence of a democratic government in Ukraine. And it is the opposite of democracy in Ukraine. We are supporting the Nazis who are in power. We are supporting the decimation of the Ukrainian military in really what is an illegal war as a proxy of NATO and European Union desires to obtain control of the Ukrainian resources and ultimately the Russian resources. So what would you do if you were Russia? You'd go and try to protect your own cultural Russians that were asking for help from Russia. So you go into Ukraine to try to help them. And at the same time, trying to broker a peace agreement that included neutrality, the original requirement of the original Ukrainian Constitution was neutrality, so that Russia would experience Ukraine as a buffer between NATO and NATO aggression, because NATO had changed from defensive to offensive in its reason for existence. Now Ukraine is anything but a buffer between NATO and Russia. So I felt compelled to present this video today because of the 75th year anniversary, not celebration, but meeting that is taking place in Washington, D.C. I mentioned that the United States is the largest contributor to NATO. The second largest is Turkey. Erdogan, the Prime Minister of Turkey, President, I forget the label, Erdogan has made it very clear that he is not in support of NATO's present aggressive posture against Russia. He has met with Putin and said, our military, which is second in capability to only the United States, Turkey's military will not be used against Russia. He's already made that very clear to Putin. So when you remove Turkey, and Erdogan is in Washington, D.C., and he's threatening, he's saying, look, we're not going to do that. He's threatening to pull out of NATO. Now, that's not going to happen immediately, but at some point, I think it is inevitable on the part of Turkey to leave NATO. While NATO is saying that it is inevitable, their word, that Ukraine will be accepted into NATO. That further exacerbates the tensions between NATO and Russia, because even if they're saying it's 2 years, 3 years down the road before Ukraine is accepted as a NATO member, the situation now is that Ukraine, for all intents and purposes, is already a member of NATO. So the threat already exists. Now, I don't want to take too much longer. It's already been an hour, but I want to spend maybe another 15 minutes, this time talking about Israel, the Palestinians, Gaza, Hezbollah, Iran, and Russia. One final note regarding Ukraine. In addition to the F-16s, I'm just looking at my notes, the F-16s being delivered from Denmark into Ukraine. Just today, there are intelligence reports that Tomahawk cruise missiles, which are normally launched from naval ships, Tomahawks are being converted for land use, to be launched from land-based launchers. And as you may know, Tomahawks are quite capable of carrying tactical nukes. And these Tomahawks, some sources say it'll be 2026 before they arrive in Ukraine. But there are other sources that are indicating that the Tomahawks right now are being converted to land deployment and deployment in Ukraine as I speak. Okay? Israel, with respect to Russia and Ukraine, what is taking place with Israel and is about to take place in Israel, as I observe it, Israel and its activities are, in military terms, referred to as a feint. F-E-I-N-T. So let me read, and we do this in the live streams, we define words. We read the definitions, so I will do that here with respect to feint. A feint attack is designed to draw defensive action towards the point under assault. It is usually used as a diversion to force the enemy to concentrate more manpower in a given area in order to weaken the opposing force in another area. Let me give you a supposition. Suppose it could be that all that has transpired with Israel at this point is towards the very near achievement of a long-term goal to divert military troops, men and materiel, from Ukraine, from Russia, Russian forces towards Lebanon, Syria, and Iran, and perhaps to a lesser extent, Yemen. Russia has been sending missiles to the Houthis in Yemen. Netanyahu, who I view in my personal observations and my personal assessment of his mental state, Netanyahu is insane, certainly delusional, but he serves a purpose. Netanyahu right now is experiencing significant division between himself and his political group that he surrounds him, very hawkish group of advisors and supporters of Netanyahu. They are in an adversarial relationship with the leadership of the IDF. The IDF has already lost almost 8,000 personnel that have either been killed or permanently disabled since their invasion of Gaza. The IDF is nearly exhausted, and yet Netanyahu is openly stating that Hezbollah to the north is an existential threat to the existence of Israel, and therefore the IDF needs to be directed against Hezbollah. And as Netanyahu has said, and the IDF has said, that if the IDF is tasked to come against Hezbollah, they will return Lebanon to the Stone Age. That's what they've said. Now, Lebanon on its part, I shouldn't say Lebanon, but Hezbollah specifically in Lebanon, in the southern half of Lebanon, has openly stated that they have over 5,000 rockets and missiles that can reach every part of Israel and carpet, blanket Israel and wipe it off the map. So when we look at this from a military standpoint, you have a nearly exhausted IDF, which is composed primarily of reserve troops. These are civilians who've been expended into Gaza. And there's a whole other discussion on Gaza, but I won't get into that tonight. But needless to say, they've lost a lot of people, and a lot of people have been permanently wounded. They've used a lot of Israeli wealth, so economic impact. A lot of their military supplies, ammunition, artillery, bombs. And now you take that force and try to direct it as a very well-equipped, much larger standing army, an army consisting of battle experience, battle-hardened troops, well-armed and reinforced and supplied and directed by Iran itself. And don't forget about Syria next door, which is in support of Hezbollah. And the command and control center for Hezbollah is in Damascus, Syria, in hardened concrete bunkers deep underground. So the statement by Israel that they are going to return Lebanon to the Stone Age, how is that accomplished? It's not boots on the ground by the IDF. It's not the IDF Air Force. Tactical nukes. Israel, and this is well known, this is public information, they have four Dolphin class submarines, each equipped with four nuclear tipped medium range missiles. Those from the Mediterranean, those missiles can reach all of Iran. Any target, anywhere in Iran, from the Mediterranean. Now, there are land-based two locations within a 10 square mile area in Israel, two mobile launching sites with multiple missile launchers that are mobile, they're on trucks, that can hit any target in Iraq. Okay? So Iraq completely and on the border of Iran itself, which includes the Iranian nuclear facility on the border. Now, in addition to submarines and land-based missiles, there are what you would call fixed position artillery missile launchers, short range, that can reach all of Lebanon, all of Syria, and into Iraq, and certainly all of Jordan, the West Bank, from the fixed missile batteries. They're all nuclear. All of what I've just described are nuclear weapons. Hundreds, upwards of 300, perhaps more, nuclear warheads sitting today on delivery vehicles, on missiles. So I call Israel the faint because Russia fully understands this. And the diversion accomplished by Israel launching tactical nukes, which is its only option, tactical nukes onto Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, and more than likely all of Lebanon, and all of Syria, including in particular and specifically Damascus, which ceases to exist overnight, and all of Iran. The Western media says, oh, Israel doesn't have the ability to engage in a strike, missile strikes against Iran, and also take care of Iraq and the West Bank and the Houthis in Yemen. That Israel doesn't have that ability. Well, if you make that statement based only on looking at boots on the ground and limited, there are some 220 fighter bomber aircraft in the Israeli Air Force. If you're only looking at those capabilities, then you could say, yeah, they don't stand a chance. This is why Russia understands that the only move now, and I'm talking imminent move by Russia, imminent move by Israel, perhaps in the next 3 weeks, and I'll explain that in a moment. The only move Israel has is the employment, the delivery of tactical nukes by short and medium range missiles, by the three delivery systems I just outlined. Turkey is also in range of these tactical nukes. Erdogan certainly knows that. He's no friend of Israel. So we have a situation here where Russia understands the only option for Israel is to go nuclear. Russia then is compelled to divert its attention away from Ukraine and portions of its military away from Ukraine. These would not be the front line Russian forces and equipment on the Ukrainian border and Ukrainian eastern territories. These will be the reserves that Russia has, and Russia has deep reserves. This would be Russia directing forces against Israel. Now, Russia has several thousand troops in Syria. Russia has a mutual defense agreement with Syria and Iran. There is not time enough for boots on the ground nor aircraft to be diverted by Russia. So what is Russia left with in terms of a timely response in defense of Syria and Iran? Tactical nukes, short and medium range nuclear warheads against Israel. This will be in response, because the question arises, who is going to be preemptive? Who's going to strike first? It will be Israel. Israel will precipitate, the first time since Hiroshima and Nagasaki in World War II, Israel will precipitate the first use of nuclear warheads since World War II. They will deliver those against Hezbollah in Lebanon, simultaneously against Syria, simultaneously against Iraq, and simultaneously against Iran. I'm coming to the conclusion here, but I want to give you why I think this is so soon. On the 24th of July, Netanyahu is scheduled to meet personally and address the U.S. Congress. No doubt he is there to ensure and reinforce U.S. support for Israel attacking Hezbollah. It will not be cited that Israel is going to target and attack Syria, Iraq, and Iran. He won't say that publicly. It will all be about Hezbollah. Will the U.S. deliver a nuclear task force into the Mediterranean just off of Cyprus, just over the horizon, and provide fighter aircraft, perhaps even artillery, ship-based artillery shelling of Lebanon, as was done in 2006. He's going to Washington to make sure that Israel can count on the United States, that the United States government military has Israel's back when Israel preemptively strikes Hezbollah. Now, what he is going to paint a picture of is conventional attack by Israel, conventional munitions against Hezbollah, in order to draw the United States in with its conventional weapons systems against Hezbollah. That is for public consumption. If it were ever known in the public arena that the U.S. understands that the only option at this point that Israel has against Hezbollah is to go nuclear, the public would not allow, and I would say our administration would not have the capability to get the military support. Forget about the civilian voice. There is no civilian voice in the United States. Our administration has deaf ears and blind eyes to any voice of its citizenry, which under the Constitution is supposed to be a republic, a representative government, democratically elected. They're not listening. They're not looking at the citizens, at their constituents. They don't care. The issue is, can the present administration get the backing and cooperation of the U.S. military, let's call it the Pentagon? Will the Pentagon support the political support of Israel? Well, the only way that's going to happen is for conventional forces to be used, conventional weapon systems to be used by the Pentagon. And that's as far as the Pentagon's going to go. They're not going to go nuclear. Not at first. The Pentagon is cooperating because they're saying, we're not going to use tactical nukes in support of Israel against Hezbollah. We're not going to do that. So this allows Israel to get the conventional support of the United States against Hezbollah. But Israel really does not need that. They want that as plan B. They want that as the backup, because here's the backup. It is nuclear. And here's how I get there. I'll give you the dominoes, and then we'll wrap this up. Israel preemptively launches on all those targets. Everything. They don't hold any nukes in reserve. It's one and done. They will release every nuclear delivery system on all targets simultaneously. Israel has no choice but to go against Hezbollah. The stated goal of Iran, therefore Hezbollah, is to wipe Israel off the map. Israel knows that, and they know that they're grossly weakened by their activities in Gaza. They know that either today or in the near future, Israel will be wiped off the map. Today or by Hezbollah, or in the near future when Iran inevitably goes nuclear, when they have the bomb, multiples. So Israel is in a no-win situation, and they put themselves in that position. If you join us on our live streams, I'll give you the biblical perspective of how Israel purposefully put itself in the position it finds itself in. I won't cite that here on YouTube. I can't. But facing an existential threat, Israel will preemptively go against that threat, which is Hezbollah, and all of the other targets that I cited. So the domino is, okay, the genie has been let out of the bottle. Pandora's box has been opened. Nukes are being used for the first time since World War II. And all of these nukes hit their targets. Russia will, because of its mutual defense agreement with Iran and Syria, will launch short and medium range tactical nukes against Israel. Medium range because of the distance. Medium range tactical nukes against Israel. And they will hit Israel. Here's the next domino. The United States and NATO. Because Putin, Moscow understands when Israel opens Pandora's box, that means the United States is going to launch its intercontinental ballistic missiles against Russia. That, in the historical sense, is a preemptive strike using ICBMs, strategic missiles is what they're called. Strategic missile defense. The United States will first launch on Russia, while the feint, Russia addressing Israel. And I'm sure Moscow's gamed this out. If I can figure it out, they've already figured it out. So when I say it's a preemptive launch by the US with ICBMs against Russia, it really is not all that preemptive. We need to think more in terms of simultaneous dominoes falling. So let's just run the timeline out. Israel, tactical nukes. Nearly instantaneously, Russia launches against Israel with tactical nukes. Nearly instantaneously, let's say simultaneously, it's a better word, simultaneously, the US launches ICBMs and in Ukraine, tactical nukes, F-16 and ground-based missile system tactical nukes, short and medium range. Short range to take out the early warning radar installations to blind Russia to the incoming ICBMs launched by the US and NATO with medium range, and virtually simultaneous to Russia launching on Israel, the feint, so to speak, Russia launches ICBMs on the United States. Now, we're not done yet. North Korea, mutual defense agreement with Russia. North Korea launches everything they have on the United States. They can reach from North Korea to the West Coast, to the Midwest, and the Eastern Seaboard of the United States, just from North Korea. And then we have China. So, Netanyahu, 24th of July, is meeting and speaking before Congress. It wants the backing of the United States because Netanyahu is going against Hezbollah. These are the dominoes. The present U.S. administration does not want a Trump NATO. They do not want Trump in office. They want to Trump-proof, their words, Trump-proof NATO. That means NATO has to act before November. This is our time frame, 24 July to November 5th elections. Those are the bookends of the timeline. 2% of the GDP of every NATO member, I shouldn't say, let's say majority NATO. We don't have Hungary, Slovakia, Turkey. They're taking monies in their budgets and allocating, directing them to their buildup of their militaries. It's been described that the next 3 months, even the Prime Minister of Hungary said this, the number of dead and wounded over the next 3 months will exceed all dead and wounded to date since the Ukrainian war began. That's what we're looking at over the next few months. Massive ramp up. If Netanyahu, this is my concluding point here tonight, if Netanyahu in his insanity is able to manipulate the IDF leadership, and the IDF understands the existential threat, they have no option but nuclear. IDF knows that better than I do. Netanyahu doesn't need NATO. Netanyahu doesn't need the United States, except on the political propaganda storefront, if you will, that the U.S. is going to back Israel. That's what will come out of his public presentation, his address to Congress. That coincides with NATO saying, we have Russia's back. We're building up. We have 100,000 troops in Europe right now. Russia understands that it cannot allow NATO to come into Ukraine. But Ukraine is not the trigger. Israel is the trigger. And the trigger that is being pulled is a nuclear trigger. I preface this at the very beginning. We're not about fear-mongering here. We're about teaching. We're about education. We're about facts. We're about evidence. We're about presenting the facts in a sober, cogent manner, in a deliberate way of looking at it factually. I will offer you this rhetorical question as a reality check. Is there a mechanism? Is there a leadership? Is there a political body? Is there a military body? Is there an economic body that can turn any of this around from its present course? Whether it's Ukraine and Russia or it's Israel and Hezbollah. Let's not forget about China and Taiwan and the South China Sea. Is there any, let's call it a mechanism, that can turn any of this around for the world? This is the state of our geopolitical state today. I've given you the pulse as I sense it, as I take the pulse of the world. I deliver to you the pulse today. Going forward, as events dictate, I will return to this platform, as well as our live streams, where I can elaborate even more and speak more freely. I will return here as often as I possibly can to deliver my observations and my expectations. We do not have much time, folks. There is no mechanism to turn any of this around. In my live streams, I'll give you the hope. I will give you the mechanism. But it is not a secular mechanism that turns this around. I would ask that you view this sober-mindedly, pragmatically, calmly, and prudently. Thank you for your time and attention, and I look forward to meeting many of you in our chat room on Band as a subscriber. Good day.